What's up, guys? If you got a Bible, pull it out. So we are doing something a little bit different tonight. We're actually going to have a panel come up, and we're going to kind of create a living room here. We're going to have a group conversation where you guys are going to be able to text in actually just questions you guys have, things that you're like, man, actually, I do experience doubt, and it's because of this thing. And so we're actually going to let you guys text that in, and we're actually going to kind of talk about it from stage, let you guys kind of guide the rest of the night. But the reason we kind of landed, hey, we're going to do this different night of salt, is actually where we're at in the series. So we're in this series called Conversations with Jesus. And we're basically looking at, man, Jesus has all these conversations with all kinds of people from every different kind of walk of life. And one of the conversations Jesus has, and where we're at tonight, is a conversation he has with Thomas, right? And so Thomas is one of Jesus' 12 disciples, right? One of the 12 apostles that starts the church. But if you've been in the church for a while, you kind of maybe know him as like Doubting Thomas, right? Because actually when Jesus rises from the dead and all the disciples come to Thomas, we're like, dude, we just saw Jesus. He's alive. It's amazing. Thomas is like, doubt it. Like he doesn't think it's true. And so I want to actually just show you guys this conversation that Jesus has with Thomas. And it's going to kind of like intro this night for us. So this is right after Jesus has risen from the dead. He's met with Mary, and he's about to show himself to kind of all the other disciples, but Thomas isn't there. And so this is John 20, 19. It's not even going to be on the screen. I'm just going to read it for you. It says this. On the evening of that day, the first day of the week, so this is Sunday, the day Jesus rose from the dead, the doors being locked where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said to them, "Peace be with you." And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side, right? Jesus was crucified, so his hands have holes in them. His side had this kind of massive hole where they put a spear in him to just check if he was dead. And so when he said this, he showed them his hands and his side, and the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. That's like a classic kind of understatement, right? They're like, we're glad about this. They're very excited, right? That's awesome. And so Jesus says some other stuff, but let's get on to verse 24. Now Thomas, one of the 12 called the twin, it's a cool nickname. Anyway, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see his hands and the mark of the nails, and I place my finger into the mark of the nails, and I place my hand into his side, I will never believe." That's a really strong rejection, right? He's like, no, it isn't like just that if I don't see him, I won't believe. He's like, no, I need to see him, and I need to actually take my finger and like put it in the hole in his hands and like put my hand into his body. Like what he's saying is like, I don't believe this at all. At all. And I'm so unconvinced by this. I so like do not believe in the resurrection that that's the only possible way I'd believe is if I literally was standing in front of me and I could like touch him and feel him and put my finger in the hole in his hands, right? That's a really, really skeptical person. Thomas, check out what happens in verse 26. 8 days later, his disciples were inside again and Thomas was with them. First of all, I think that's funny. An entire week goes by and like all the other disciples were like, this is amazing. Jesus is risen from the dead. And they're like talking about like the future of the world and how awesome it'd be. And Thomas is like, no, no. Like he's just there with them the whole time. So anyway, it says this, although the doors were locked once again, Jesus came and stood among them and he said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." And Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? But blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Now, I really love this story. It's like Jesus knows that some of the kind of people who are going to come upon his story, like when they're reading the Gospels or in the New Testament or something, and they know that they're going to like come upon his story, and people are going to say, hey, like Jesus rose from the dead. And he knows that there's going to be some people who are like, doubt it. Like, I'm pretty sure that didn't happen, right? And so Jesus takes someone who's like the most skeptical version, maybe, of someone in this room, and it goes, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take that person and put them into my core circle of disciples so that when I actually do raise from the dead, there's going to be this person who represents this kind of rational, logical, critical person. And right, all the disciples are like, Thomas, we saw Jesus. Like, remember we went to the tomb and it was empty and we were all like, what the heck is going on? Like, we saw him and we all saw him at the same time and like we touched him. Thomas, he's alive. Thomas is like, no, I literally won't believe unless I see evidence, physical evidence I can touch and kind of get my hands into and really understand to the fullest of my intellectual abilities. Thomas is skeptical, not just skeptical, he doesn't believe it happened at all. And here's a question, right? Because does Thomas want Jesus to be alive? Because he's presented with that, like, potential truth, right? They're like, Thomas, Jesus is alive. Did Thomas want Jesus to be alive? Yeah, of course he did. This is someone who spent the last years of his life devoting all of his life to following Jesus. He left his job, he left his family, he left his entire way of life just to follow Jesus. And when Jesus died, all of his hopes and dreams were put in the ground with Jesus. Thomas wants Jesus to be alive, but he can't believe it's true. It would be the greatest thing to possibly happen to him, and yet it seems like an impossibility to him. It's insane to him. Like, he watched Jesus' body get lowered into the ground. He watched Jesus be clearly dead. And so in his point of view, he's like, the magic's gone, the healer was killed, the light of the world was snuffed out, and all my hope with him. And here's what's true. It isn't that Thomas didn't want to believe in the resurrection. Thomas wanted to believe that was true. I guarantee you, even as he heard that, he was like, I wish that was true. I want that to be true. I just can't believe it's true. His skepticism was this like thing that kept him from being able to embrace that idea. His doubt was like this wall he couldn't get over. It was like this obstacle in his path that needed to be removed before he could ever even think about having faith in the risen Messiah. He needed to actually know and believe that Jesus actually had risen from the dead. And so the very first thing I want just us to kind of intro this conversation with is that it's like what Dalton said, right? Doubt is real. It's real. And I think that doubt's real in a lot of different ways in this room, right? Doubt might be for you very real and you're like, yeah, I'm not a Christian. I'm just got invited tonight. And there's the reason I'm not a Christian is because of this thing, right? I have doubts about this. You might be someone in the room, you're like, I actually do, I follow Jesus, but there's certain things that have come up in my life or in certain circumstances or even certain things I've read in the Bible that are confusing for me. And you might have doubt that you're like, I want to follow Jesus, I am following Jesus, but I have this thing that kind of makes me anxious about it. Because the first thing is doubt is real. And when you have something as miraculous and amazing as the story that the Bible presents to us, I actually think that one of the most natural things at first is to doubt it, right? Like when you have a story like the gospel that presents such an, like, kind of an unbelievable thing, right? The very first thing is to disbelieve it. It's like when you get an email and it's like, hey, you're like, oh, what's this email about? And it's like, oh my gosh, like the king of Uganda is trying to unload like millions of dollars and he needs a bank account to put it in and and I'm the only person that can help him. And if I give him my bank account info, he's going to give me this money, and then when he comes to America, then I'll give some of it back, but I'll get to keep a lot. This is awesome, right? It's like we live in a world where like we're trained. It's like that seems too good to be true. It's like it's because it is, right? And the gospel's like that. The gospel's like that, where it seems so unbelievably good that it seems like it can't possibly be true, can it? Because if the resurrection of Jesus is true, and it accomplished what the authors of the Bible tell us it accomplished, then it means that the world's not the same anymore. If the story of the Bible is true, it means that all of the injustice that we see in the world and we can't stand and we hate, it means that one day all of that is going to be accounted for. It means that death is not actually going to have the final say. It means that resurrection is going to lead us to this world where there is no more suffering, there is no more pain, there is no more death. If the Bible is true and Jesus rose from the dead, it means that the beauty we see and experience, and it means that the love that we feel for the closest people in our lives, it means that that isn't just like some kind of bumping up of like neurons in your brain that's just like happening to produce this feeling in you, but it's meaningless and it's purposeless. No, if Jesus actually rose from the dead and God actually exists and has come into our world, it means that the way we perceive things in the world, they have meaning, they have value. It means that this isn't just some cosmic accident. It means that the purpose and value that we see in the world, it's not just an illusion that's developed as a result of millions of years of natural selection and chaos, but it means that the way we view the world, the way we love people, the way that we see beauty and experience poetry and art and the way we hear someone speak to us and we have affection for them, it means that that's actually real and it has meaning. And if the story of the Bible is true, it means that things like sexual assault and racism and slavery, it means that they're actually wrong like we feel they're wrong. Not just like against our constitution that a bunch of old people wrote sometime, but like wrong, evil, like against this bigger law that's way above what we write in some things. It's wrong because all of us have been stamped with the image of God and we have value and worth that's intrinsic within all of us. If the story of the Bible is true, it means that we haven't just awoken to consciousness in some kind of meaningless fight for cosmic survival, but it actually means that we have a creator. And if the story of Jesus is true, if the story of the gospel is true, it means that the creator isn't distant and he isn't far away. He didn't just like kind of set the world to spin and just kind of let it go abandoned and on its own to whatever end it might have. But no, it means that we have a father in heaven who loves us and who is present and who is near, who loves us enough that he would give up his one and only son for us. That he would come into the broken world that we call home and he would experience pain and suffering and sadness and even death so that he could recreate the world into the way it was supposed to be. So that all that is broken would one day be fixed. All that's broken in our world and our lives would one day be made new. That all that is sad would be made good. And that one day our eyes, they would open and they would see the face of our Creator. And that we would live in his goodness and light in this undying world with the rest of his redeemed and restored creation forever. It's a really good thing, right? And Thomas comes face to face with that reality, right? He's like, if Jesus rose from the dead, that's what this means. And he wants so badly to believe it's true, but he just can't believe it. There's too much going against it. He's like, people don't normally rise from the dead. It's been around a while. It's not a normal thing. If he's really risen, then why haven't I seen him? How can someone actually die a death like that? Like that brutal, right? I get if you're like maybe one of the people that Jesus has healed where they're like, oh, they have this fever and they go down and like they are dead, but like they didn't get their body ripped apart like Jesus did. So he's like, how could someone come back from that? He says, I tell you, unless I put my finger in the holes in his body, I will never believe. So what does Jesus do? He says, okay. Jesus goes, okay, Thomas. I love you. I care about you. Here you go. Have at it. 8 days later, he's like, I was busy. I don't know what he's doing, but he comes back. He's like, hey, here's my hands. Here's my side. You want to put your hand in here? Go ahead. You want to like figure out like with your logical, rational mind, like, is this true? Do you believe this? He goes, okay, do it. One of the things that makes Christianity different from every other religion is because if Jesus didn't actually raise from the dead, then all of this is for nothing. It sets it apart, actually. Christianity is unique in that way because many religions and philosophies are based on some kind of story or myth, right? And whether that really happened doesn't matter so much. It's just like the power is in the story itself. And who knows if this kind of old mythology, like if that really happened or not. What's powerful is this story, and if you believe this story, it can change your life, not Christianity. No, if Jesus didn't actually raise from the dead, then it's worthless. One of like the people who wrote most of the Bible, the Apostle Paul, would say that. He said, if Jesus didn't actually raise from the dead, then Christians amongst all people are to be pitied. Because the power isn't in the story, it's in the person. The power isn't in the teachings that Jesus left us, that we would follow them and become these good kind of people, but the power is in the Holy Spirit that he promises to put inside of those with faith in him. The power is in him being alive and real and actually promising to come back for those who love him. So doubt, okay? That's what we're talking about tonight. Doubt is something one of the very first leaders of the church experienced when we first heard that Jesus had risen from the grave. And yet later, the same disciple is going to be martyred for his faith, according to church history, claiming that he saw and experienced the risen Christ, right? Jesus' conversation with Thomas, you guys have to hear this. His conversation with Thomas, it isn't trying to coax him into taking a blind leap of faith, right? And it isn't actually trying to convince Thomas to just believe and have faith in something that you intellectually know isn't true. No, Jesus' conversation with Thomas involves his physical resurrected body. Evidence. He's like, I want you to actually do that. Examine me. Touch this. Look at this. See this. What conclusions do you draw? And so, guys, that's what tonight's about. I'm someone who has, over the course of my years walking with Jesus, there have been a number of different times where I've experienced doubt, like real doubt about like, is this true? Do I not just believe in this specific piece of doctrine in the Bible? Like, do I believe the whole thing? And so one of the things I think is super helpful to do is do the exact thing Thomas did and actually just say, you know what? I have questions about this. I have doubt. I have something I'm skeptical about that's keeping me from being able to be like all in with Jesus, or even like keeping me kind of just my faith weak, and I'm not able to like as strongly have faith in Jesus as I want. And so here's what we're gonna do, okay? This whole night's gonna change a lot in a second. You guys are gonna be able to determine what we talk about the rest of the night, okay? So here's what we're gonna do. Pull out your phone if you got it. You guys, I want you guys to think about this. What is something that's either maybe an experience you've had, or maybe it's something you've read, or maybe someone you've talked with, or maybe it's just something you've read in the Bible, but so you go, man, this thing, this causes doubt in my life. Or maybe you're here and you don't believe in Jesus, you don't believe in any of this, someone just brought you and you're like, well, the reason I'm like, dude, I'm not even gonna come back is because of this. You guys need to wrestle with this thing. Jesus isn't afraid of any part of his world that we might stumble upon something or like, oh no, and now we're like, Jesus is like, hey, take a look. Whatever corner of the universe you want to poke into and look around, like, I'm fine with that because I made the whole thing. And so what I want you guys to do is just think, what are those questions? And you guys are going to actually, we're going to throw this on the screens here. You guys are going to go to this website right there, www.soi.do. All right? You just go soi.do, you go there, and it's gonna give you a box, okay? In this box, you're gonna type in this code. This is our event code, hashtag N795, okay? So you're gonna type that in, and then it's gonna actually pull up kind of our event we're doing tonight, and then what you can do is you can write your question, okay? So not everyone has to, if you don't have a good question, don't ask a question. But if you have a real question, ask it. And then what you can do is you can actually see the questions that are popping up, and you can actually like thumbs up if you're like, ooh, this is a good question, I wanna know an answer to that, okay? So do that, we're about to change this, bring some couches out, I'm gonna bring some friends up, we're gonna have a little panel discussion. All right, we'll see you back here in like a minute. All right, so, all right guys, thanks for sending these in. Thanks for giving us such softball questions. No, I'm just kidding, these are really great, these are hard. So here's what I wanna start. So this is a question that will get us started. Well, let me first introduce you guys. So this is Eric Bodine. Eric is an elder at Veritas Church. He's great. If you guys don't come to Veritas Church, you should on Sundays. We want to invite all you guys out. It's right here on Sunday morning. So this is Rebecca Johnson. So Rebecca is a published author, right? Wow, yeah, big time. So she kind of helps with women's ministry here at Veritas. She kind of helps do kids ministry. And she knows the Bible better than I think every single one of you in the room. So you guys should listen to what she has to say. And this is Jeff Dodge, my really good friend from Ames, who now lives in Iowa City, which is awesome. So Jeff has a PhD, which gives us some legitimacy, all right? So anyway, so I'm going to give all the hard questions to Jeff, and we'll see if he can answer them. So here's the first one, all right? How do we know the Bible is exclusively true? And so, because basically what we're saying is, man, we're every single night we're coming here, we're opening the Bible and saying, this is God's word. Why do we know that the Bible is true and exclusively true? Meaning like, this is uniquely true compared to other religious texts. What makes the Bible unique?
I was just waiting for somebody else to jump in, but So when it comes to that question, I'll just speak personally, okay, from me, not academically or something, just from my own soul, is even in general when it just comes to doubts, right? Like whether it's how do we know the Bible is really the word from God, that kind of thing. honestly, I start from a different place than the Bible. I start with, I walk outside and I look around, or I look at the delicacy of a flower, or the, you know, like when the ancients, you guys, when the ancients looked, I'm supposed to be brief, I'll be quick. When the ancients looked up at the skies, they called that the cosmos, right? Because the word means to beautify. That's why we get the same word when women put makeup on their face, call them cosmetics, make beautiful, right? So there's something beautiful in studying, like there's the cosmos. And so what I'm saying is I have this breathless sensation when I see the stars or other aspects of creation. So that here's what that starts me on a journey. Well, so what is it about this internal antenna? What is it about this something in me that connects with something out there that is beyond the material world? Something intuitive tells me, and you guys all have the exact same experience. It's experienced globally and throughout the ages. We have this fixed antenna that just keeps receiving these signals that there is a God. The Bible actually validates that. The Bible actually has many passages, but one is like in Psalm 19, where the heavens declare the glory of God. There's like a message coming from the heavens. Their expanse declares the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. So I first established there's something or someone out there beaming this down to me. Now I've got to figure out how can I return the favor and get to know that God as well. So then I start opening my Bible, and it corresponds to all of the intuitive wonderings that I've had, and it takes me on that journey. And so I've read the Bhagavad Gita and the Quran, and there's all sorts of options out there for literature. None of them even make the claims that this does or correspond to the reality that I have intuitively when I just walk outside and look at the incredible stars or an ocean or the charm of a baby crying. And so I don't actually start from the Bible. The Bible actually confirms the reality that I have as I express my humanness and look at the skies.
Yeah.
But I would say at the same time, if you start with the Bible, it does make exclusive claims for itself. It makes exclusive claims for Jesus. And so you have to deal with that. You have to say, okay, is this true? Does it logically make sense? And so you can, there's different ways to come at it. And you can start with the Bible and say, is this reliable? Is this a reliable historical document? What does it say? Where did it come from? You can get into all of that. And the Bible stands up against any other historical document. And it makes that exclusive claim, obviously, especially for Jesus, that there's no other way to heaven, that it is, this is the creator God of the universe. It's the record of his interactions with men, right? And so it makes that claim. And so you have to deal with that when you come to the Bible.
I think that there's things about the way the Bible is written that even in 2019, we look at as like people who are into history and go, man, this seems like this is written in a different kind of way than someone who's just gonna like make up a story, right? I mean, you read the Quran and it's like, oh, you die and you go to heaven, you get 70 virgins. Like, seems like a dude wrote that, you know? I mean, it just like, there's things about that that you're like, oh yeah, like that seems like the kind of thing a guy in a desert would write. And you come to the Bible and it's like a totally different thing. It takes everything we would normally think about the world and flips on its head. And you're like, oh my gosh, like we would have never come up with this, you know? One of the things I like to talk about when I'm in conversations with people, they're saying, well, why Christianity? What makes it unique? Every single religion is fundamentally one very simple pattern, right? Every single religion in the world except Christianity follows this pattern. It's, hey, there's, you know, God's here, transcendence is here, and you're here. And there's some path to God, whether through the way you think or the way you live, there's something. And you need to figure out how you live a certain kind of life to get up to the divine, right? Christianity is the only religion that flips on its head and says, no, you could never get to the divine. And actually the divine came and became like you, and became a human being, and actually entered into our world of suffering and pain and death and died on your behalf. And because of that, he now invites you to be where he is. It's a totally unique pattern that you won't find in any other religion in the world. It's utterly unique. So I would say for that reason, here's what I think. It's possible that every single other religion in the world is true, except Christianity. Or it's possible that Christianity is the one true religion and all others are false, because they're so utterly unlike each other. You could say every other religion, oh yeah, this is different, you know, parts of an elephant, we're all feeling a different way. You can't do that with Christianity. It's too unique.
And just to, real quick to add to that, some of the stats kind of about the Bible. Written over, there's 66 books in the Bible, right? Written over 1,500 years by 40 different authors on 3 different continents from all walks of life. Different, you know, there's farmers, there's prophets, there's kings, there's all these different walks of life. Yet when you read through the Bible, you get a consistent revelation of the one true God to his people. And so just those facts alone should make you think, wow, this book is different. I'm going to approach it differently. And I think it will, some people talk about kind of being self-confirming witness of the Bible. I think that's what will happen.
All right, let's move on. Man, there's so many good questions. I'm trying to figure out one that doesn't lead to a 45-minute long answer on its own. Here's a question. Is it actually sinful to have women lead in the church? All right, one of the things you're going to come up with is, and yeah, it's convenient that you're here. But like one of the questions, right, is this, is it's like, hey, like some of the ways that the Bible talks about men and women and men's and women's roles, that pushes up against some of the ideas that we have in culture. And so I do think that's actually a barrier for some people where they go, well, I can't even have a conversation about Jesus because of the way it talks about men and women in the church. So you're on this stage talking.
I am. Yeah. I'm on the stage talking, and there's not lightning coming from the sky.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, I could talk about this for a really long time, so I will just hit a couple bullet points. Let me speak to the women in this room who have doubts tonight. There is nothing in this book that can hurt you. That is not my quote, but there is nothing in this book that will hurt you. You do not need to stay away from it or stay away from God because you hear that this says something different than culture and you think that you can't flourish in the way the Bible gives us roles and gives us distinction. So that, let me speak to your heart with that. Beyond that, is it sinful for a woman to lead in a church? Absolutely not. Leadership is a gift that is given from the Holy Spirit. We have work to do. We have, we have gifts and skills and personalities that the church needs. Do I think that men and women have absolutely equal worth and value? Yes. Where do I get that? Scripture. Specifically, all the way back in the first pages of it. We have the same worth, the same value. To put this brief, I would say we have a distinction in our role. So we have different jobs to do, just like you see in the Trinity. So you see Father, Son, Holy Spirit. They're equal in value and worth, but they interact with one another. They have a distinction in their roles and how they interact with us and throughout creation. And so that is the really, really, really short answer. There's also a spectrum of where people line up on what exactly a woman can and should do. What does the Bible teach a woman should do in the church? And you know, there's one end of the spectrum, which would be patriarchal, which would say like, I should absolutely not be up here, and women, you should be home already rearing children. There's another end over here, which is feminism and even secular feminism. And then there's this ground in the middle where there is some gray area on how people interpret different parts of the scripture. But equal in value, different in distinction. Nothing in here can hurt you. God's design allows for both the men and the women to flourish when we are his image bearers doing it as he commands. There's a lot more to that.
Nice, yeah. And any of these questions, guys, too, like don't just, you know, there's more to that, the answer, right, that we don't have time for. So come up afterwards and talk to Rebecca if you're someone who's like, hey, you're up on that stage. I feel this. And so, yeah, ask her more on that stuff later. Okay, here's one. Why do unreached people who've never heard of Jesus, why does the Bible, or would the Bible put those people into say, hey, in the end, they're going to receive the wrath of God because they didn't receive Jesus, even though they've never heard Jesus? I think that's the substance of that question. So what does the Bible teach on those people? And
yeah,
what do we do with that?
you can, I'll just kind of softball to pitch to you. It says in Romans that, you know, everything about God actually is revealed in nature, like what Jeff said, his eternal power, his character is actually revealed. So the big, big picture that we can talk about is that God makes himself known. That's the God of Christianity, is he is a God who made himself known throughout all the stories in the Old Testament and then at a climactic point with Jesus.
So for someone who just, if I'm in the audience, I'm like, okay, well, what if they don't have the Old Testament? Well, they don't have the story of Jesus. All they have is the night sky. And they're like, dude, we made a religion for that. We get it. Like, the night sky is amazing, and that's all we have. And so we, you know, I mean, you go to like certain tribes, and it's like, we've made a song, and we don't know what's out there, but we're trying our best to worship it. What do you say to that?
Yeah, there are several passages, but there's one in the book of Ecclesiastes that talks about how God has put eternity into the hearts of every man and woman, that there is this sense of the divine, there is this sense of the eternal. When you open the book of Romans, what you realize is there are no innocent, just ignorant people. All of us have suppressed the truth in our unrighteousness. That's the way the book of Romans talks about it. That actually what you've got is not a world full of innocent people who just, I didn't know. What we've got is a world of people who, what I do know about God, I actually don't respond rightly, but I end up realizing, wait, I start connecting the dots. So that experience I talked about before, wait a minute, if there's a God, man, I start connecting the dots. That God probably made me. Wait, if there's a God out there that made me, I wonder if I'm in some way responsible back to that God. I wonder if I'm going to have to stand before that God. And so you even have people who have never read their Bible talk about things like, you're going to meet your maker. You know what I mean? That's not a Bible verse, right? That's just this inherent idea. We start connecting dots. As soon as I connect those dots far enough, then I'm like, I don't want to deal with that kind of God. I don't want to have to meet my maker. And so I start suppressing what little bit I know, even if it's just come from the antenna, without opening my Bible, I suppress the truth in my unrighteousness. That is the experience globally. Whether you've been raised in a home with Bible teaching and telling you all about those things right from the scriptures, or if you have never opened a Bible and have never been exposed to it. And so that's the starting point, actually, is that God, by his grace, actually pierces through the darkness of all that, brings us the story of salvation. And he does that for you, for me. We find that globally. In fact, there's this really cool book called, I think it's called Eternity in Their Hearts, where in phenomenal supernatural ways, God is getting the gospel to these people groups and all over. In fact, Eric, you've even spent some time among some of those unreached people groups. Seeing that God has already gone before and prepared the way, and the gospel is flourishing in those places. But I just want to make sure that our starting point is at the right place, that idea of the innocent ignorance is not true of you any more than it's true of anybody around the world. We've suppressed the truth in our unrighteousness, so it's God by his grace piercing through that darkness to draw us to himself.
So a question that I think fits into that is the number one question, 81 thumbs up, so that's something, is this. Does God predestine people to hell?
Well, that... Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, I don't have a PhD, so...
The Bible doesn't... Here's the deal. We try to find categories. In fact, even just this coming Saturday, I'm going to be teaching an all-day seminar. A few of the people in this room are going to be there on systematic theology, which is... Systematic theology is basically finding topics and then tracing the answers to that topic. It's like, what's an angel? Let's start in Genesis 1 and work our way to the other end to see what does the Bible kind of in a holistic way speak to these different things. Just so you know, the Bible never declares things like God creates people in order to send them to hell. Those kind of categories are more in the realm of philosophy, where you start thinking, well, wait a minute, if there's a God and if he has chosen some to himself, does he also just choose some to go ahead and predestine them? It's called double predestination, predestine them for damnation. What I'm saying is you might muse about some things like that and have friends talk about things like that. That's not, you're not going to find that here in the scriptures. So I honestly... I work very hard at harnessing everything that I say, like emphatically or with conviction, to those things that I can trace clearly right back to the scriptures, right? Now, beyond that, we can have all sorts of conversation about what's in between there and what are some logical, maybe, implications. But I don't hold a conviction level or a confidence level at that. What I'm saying is, in the scriptures, for instance, there's a book, there's this verse in 1 Peter chapter 2 that talks about there will be false teachers that kind of invade the church, as there have always been false prophets and false teachings all around. And it says this, even denying these guys, these prophets, false prophets, even denying the sovereign Lord who bought them. Wait a minute, he bought them, he purchased them, but they're false teachers and are under his punishment. How does all that work? The Bible's going to give us curveballs all the time, I think often, to put us in our place and to help us to realize that there's levels of mystery that we will spend all of eternity chasing down and sitting in wonder of. So it's a difficult, logical problem, but no, the Bible never says that he creates human beings in order that they would go to hell.
I think maybe something just like to give you guys the next steps, if those are the kind of questions, those kind of, I would almost call them like these topical questions that are just huge and looming on your horizon, a better way to start to approach those is to maybe think about studying who God is. What are the characteristics of God? What is the list of characteristics of, like, okay, throughout time, like, this is the 10 top characteristics of God. And know those, read those, look for those in scriptures, and then take those and put them on top of your big questions like predestination. Because the answer that you're going to find about like a question like predestination, it has to line up with who God is. There can't be a contradiction. And if God is love, you know, what does it mean that God is loving, that he is merciful, but also that he is just? And, you know, so there's it's almost just like a more strategic way to get your questions answered is to start with who is God, because that's actually, you know, I mean, it seems like a simple thing, but this book is about God. He is the main character from beginning to the end. It's about him. And so we should be spending more time learning who he actually is and forming our minds. And we'll find that those questions that kind of can discourage our hearts or put doubt there will then actually find peace and find a better place to struggle through with it.
Yeah, and these last two questions, the questions like that, you can't let them keep you from coming to Christ. If you think, well, if some dude in the bush who's never heard of Jesus dies and goes to hell, then I'm going to go to hell too, you know? You can't let that keep you, this hypothetical person or question, don't let that keep you from coming. And also kind of what Rebecca was saying, don't think that you have to have all of the answers right away, right? I was talking to my friend last night. He's going to study epidemiology. And if I started making judgments about epidemiology after a few conversations with my friend, that's ridiculous, right? I don't know anything about it. It's worth a lifetime of study. How much more is, again, the creator God of the universe who commanded the world into existence, how much more is he worth a lifetime of study and days of careful consideration?
So real quick, along the way, I hope that we can offer just a few resources. So if there's something that you want to chase down a little bit more, which, by the way, even on Women in the Church, I don't know if you have one or two that you would want to throw up. But when it comes to this one, a standard that I would highly recommend would be Knowing God by J.I. Packer. So he's an old dead guy. He's barely dead. He is not that old.
Wait, does that mean? Is he dead or not?
he is, but not for very long. Not like some ancient.
Mostly dead.
I'm not dead yet. Anyway.
They are way too young. None of them know what that joke was.
Okay, we're just going to move on. The J.I. Packer, Knowing God, would be a great place. Exactly, you know, what Rebecca was talking about. Man, if you're going to pick up a guide, you know, somebody else, a mentor you it back into the Bible, I would highly recommend J.I. Packer, Knowing God.
Wow, there's some really good questions towards the bottom of here. Holy cow. We're not going to do the wet dreams one. We'll just let you guys. You go ask your connection group leader that question. All right.
You just did. You just threw it out there.
Oh, I threw it out
there. I'm going to skip this one.
Yeah, I'm going to skip that one.
I mean, I am a nurse. I could.
Fair, yeah. All right. So the very top question is this. Why are people made LGBTQ plus if God sees those desires and acts as sinful? So just so you guys know, we're planning to actually talk about this kind of after spring break, after Salt Company, in maybe a more more of a long format way, more thought out way. I do think this is actually probably one of the most important topics kind of for the church today, right? Is how do we not be callous and careless with people who are made in the image of God, who have same-sex attraction, who view themselves in like they view their body and they're like, man, this is, I don't feel like this represents the real me, right? This is really real, and it's really serious. And so I think what I don't want to do is give a really off-the-cuff answer to something that's important enough to give a really full answer. Let's just table that one. We're actually going to talk about it after Salt Company in a few weeks. But I think that there's some things that are important enough that if you just answer off the cuff, you can actually do kind of an injustice, not just to the Bible stance on this, but actually an injustice to people who are in the LGBTQ plus community, because it's actually really important that we give a good answer to that. So we're going to in a few weeks. Okay. So sorry about and that, but
just
back.
As a primer for that though, I do want to say, guys, please don't feel like if whoever wrote that, it's a reflection of your own sincere question, because I would want to sit down with whoever wrote that, because what I want to know is, are you kind of on the attack? And so you want to know, how can I use the Bible to shut down a people group? I'd talk to you differently than if you're saying, actually, that's my experience, and I really want to know what the Bible says, right? Yeah. And so, first of all, that's why I appreciate what you're saying, David. This takes a longer discussion. I'd want to get to the person, to the human that's asking that. But the idea, at least at its foundational level, is I find desires in here that don't correspond to, it seems like, what God says should be true or appropriate. That's the experience of all of us. And so I just don't want you to feel so isolated. And sometimes I feel like it can be the perception that the church has a special category for the LGBT community. And what I'm saying is that's actually not true. I want to take a longer time, what you're talking about. But I just at least take the pressure valve down and recognize that in general, we're all facing some level of that very question.
Oh, so, totally. Anyway. Yeah. Yep. So yeah, we will talk about that very soon, and hopefully in depth enough that it's helpful. Here's a question. I'm not Christian, but I'm not as sure as I used to be about my stance on religion. What can help me see the truth? I want to believe, but I can't deny science. Okay. So this would be, I would just say, all my cards on the table. This is the thing for me that I was just telling backstage, probably once a year, I have a pretty pretty significant season of doubt. Like it's maybe a week or 2 weeks or even like 3 weeks long where I, and normally it has to do with science. Normally it has to do with big questions, evolution. Like I've read a lot of that stuff. And there's a lot in that that's actually really compelling. There's a lot in that that actually does kind of push against my faith when I'm reading it. My four best friends growing up in high school, we went to this little Christian school, and they, I became a pastor, which is hilarious, and they all became like really, really strong atheists. And so whenever we hang out and talk, I mean, they send me books like, hey, read this and you'll disbelieve in God. I'm like, okay, I'll read it. And there's like really real stuff out there. And so what I would say for me, maybe I'll just kind of answer this question, is there are certain things that science can't answer that are actually the most important questions that I have in my life, you know? Like there's a lot in there that I'm like, man, I'll be really honest. Like there's things about that I'm reading and I'm like, I don't actually know exactly what to do with some of the things that seem to be coming out in science, right? Anthropology today is gonna say, hey, like if you study it, it seems like we don't have a common ancestor. And it's like, well, okay, that's really problematic for a lot of things. But I would just say for that area of science, what I do with that just straight up is I go, I don't know what to do with that. I don't know enough about anthropology. I just think that if it's true that we don't have a common ancestor and we're not actually family, that like gets vetoed straight away. I'm like, I don't want to live in a world where I look at someone from another race or another place and go, no, I don't have like this reason to value on the same status as me because we're actually fundamentally different. I just reject that straight away, right? So there's some areas of science like that where I go, I almost refuse to believe that because of the kind of world it would create, right? There's other areas of science where Christians don't need to fight against it, and they do, right? So one of the really common things is this, like, how old is the earth? The Bible doesn't say, and frankly, I don't think it cares, right? And so one of the things that people do is you walk into a, you know, college class on evolution or chemistry, whatever, any science, and what's presented really clearly is, hey, the earth's way older than 6,000 years. And you know what? It certainly seems to be older than 6,000 years. One of the reasons that Christians will say, no, we need to hold to this is because if you go back to the Old Testament and you add up people's ages and you add up the lineages, you get to some number around 5,000 to 7,000 years. And so people assume that's what the point of the ages are, is to tell Christians how old the earth should be so that when someone comes and says it's old, we're supposed to really dogmatically fight against that. That's a foolish way to read the Bible. That is not what the authors intended. That's not what God intended for those ages to be. And so one of the things I think we need to ask, if you're someone who's like, I want to believe, but science is something that I believe in this, I would just say, make sure that the thing you're believing in science is actually conflicting with what the message of the Bible is. If the thing that you see in science is it seems like the earth's really old and a lot of things have changed over a really long period of time, I would say, okay, I don't think there's a problem there. But if you're talking about like a really specific theory of Darwinian evolution where there is no guidance, there is no design, there is no God, it is completely the process of random chaotic things, the process of natural selection and natural selection alone, and you're like, that is science, I would say, no, that is philosophy, okay? And so what you've done is you've taken some science and you've put on top of that a worldview and a religion, and you've kind of spit that out and said, this thing conflicts with Christianity. And I'd say, oh, absolutely, they do. But that isn't necessarily the scientific findings. And so, anyway, that's, did anybody else have anything to add on that?
Here's the deal, that often the stories that seem to derail Christianity get the headlines. Yeah, yeah. It actually works the opposite all the time. So there's an astronomer, that Guillermo Gonzalez wrote this book, Dr. Guillermo Gonzalez wrote this book, because he was in India as an astronomer checking out this incredible, you know, eclipse. And as he's checking it out, looking through the telescope, this learned guy all of a sudden starts adding pieces together. He's like, no, wait a minute. What are the chances that the moon would be perceived from this vantage point on this small blue dot to be the almost exact diameter of the sun? And wait, what are the chances that that would happen in such a way that only like 0.5% would be reduced enough to allow us to study all the rays and to see all the different things coming off of the sun that we wouldn't be able to see with our bare eyes? Wait a minute, what are the chances that all that would happen with a transparent atmosphere? If we lived on Venus, the atmosphere would be opaque and cloudy. We wouldn't be able to see. So he starts adding up all the, what are the chances? What are the chances? What are the chances? And suddenly he's like, without ever opening a Bible, without even connecting it, therefore Jesus died on the cross for my sins. No, he didn't go there. He all of a sudden just said, I think it's at least possible that there's more design to this thing than I was willing to admit before. And he just followed in his entire book, never mentions Jesus, never gives, but at least science itself took him down a path. Now he did end up becoming a Christian, but he didn't write about that part or whatever. It was just science itself started adding up. Biologists do this all the time. So I'm saying science often, when followed, chases us back this way. It's just not as sexy. It doesn't get as many
headlines.
And
he was in Ames, right?
Yes.
He was a professor, and he didn't get tenure, right?
That's right. So he was one, maybe some of you are old enough to remember, that wasn't that many years ago, was denied tenure because of this book that he wrote called The Privileged Planet. And it was really an injustice because he published more than many of his colleagues, that had nothing to do with this, those kind of discoveries. But because he kind of on the side published this book of his findings, was denied tenure. So sometimes
I think that if you're going to be someone who's like, hey, I have skepticism about this religion thing, I'm like, that's great, that's fine. You should have a lot of healthy skepticism towards the community that's called the community of science. There's a lot of really, really, really good scientists who have some really legitimate findings that seem to push against kind of the modern scientific dogma of the day. And basically what consistently happens every single time is if you put your head above, it's like whack-a-mole, right? As soon as you say, hey, maybe this thing isn't actually right, and immediately it's like, well, off with your head, because if you go against our kind of dogma, I mean, it's religion, right? That's what it is. And so if you step up, it's like you stand up in church and go, I don't believe this. It's like, then get out of here. You can't be part of our group. And so the more I've read about science, the more literature I've read, the more people I've read kind of condemning what seems to be like pretty legitimate findings, basically the more I've come to a place where I just go, I don't know how to trust you, actually. And so I have a pretty healthy bit of skepticism for kind of what science says about things. And I read a lot. And I would just say, you should have that same level of healthy skepticism. You got anything before we move on?
Yeah, I think maybe just on a more practical level too, guys, like lots of times science and other things like that can be rabbit holes. You know, you just get to a darker place and you're further away and you start, you know, cycling, you know, and it's not actually helpful. It's just something super practical. If you're going to read and you want to go down those paths and learn what the scientists say, at least read your Bible the same amount of time. Like, give God a chance to defend himself through his word. And even just, you know, just if you have that book about science open or that website or whatever, have your Bible open as well. I think something that is so sweet about the way that God has made his church to be. It's like, we're not up here saying, well, the only way to not have doubt is for you to turn your brains off and just use your heart. Like, this is just about feelings. Faith is just about feelings. Like, not at all. Like, we want you to bring your minds and engage your minds. But we are, aware that you can find the Lord.
Let God speak for himself.
Yeah, let God speak for himself. Totally. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, there's a ton we can learn from scientists. Obviously, science has improved our lives a lot. And there's a ton of good things that we can learn.
Totally.
And a lot of scientists, they do have a worldview where mountains don't move, right? And if you just live in a world where you assume that mountains don't move, you can do a lot of good things. That's a very solid philosophy. But in a biblical worldview, sometimes God moves mountains, right? And so there's going to be things they can't explain that only God can explain. So, science is obviously can be very, very beneficial. So.
Yep, no, for sure, yeah. I mean, I'm glad that we have dentistry, for one. That's great. We were talking about that earlier. We were like, isn't that amazing? Literally just the fact that we have dentists is incredible. We don't die from always like cysts on the top and the bottom. Yeah, science is great. Anyway, we're not dissing science. We're just saying you should have a healthy skepticism of some of the things that, when it goes beyond the level to philosophy, I think that's where you need to jump off the boat. So, but whoever wrote that question and you're like, dude, I seriously got questions, come talk after. We'll get more into it. Okay, here's a question. How hard do I have to pray to get someone to ask me out? Here's a legitimate one.
Talk to my wife, she'll set you up.
Do you have anything on that one though?
No.
How hard?
Pass.
Okay, pass. Yeah. Harder than you're currently praying.
It was her brother. It was Ryan.
Yeah. Oh, that's tough. Sorry, man. Sorry about that one. Okay, what about dinosaurs? Real quick, this is like a quick one. What about dinosaurs? They're not in the Bible, and for sure they existed, right? Or at least seems like they did.
Why do you say they're not in the Bible?
Because that's the prevailing thing.
No, that wasn't sassy. Like, yeah. I mean,
I feel like you're about to show me where Triceratops is in the original Hebrew. Yeah.
No, I think there are some terms used in the Old Testament that describe an animal, a reptile that we don't see right now. So, short answer.
So the Leviathan, that is the Brachiosaurus.
Yeah, I think Jonah was swallowed by a sea monster that looked somewhat like a dinosaur.
Nice. Okay. So Jonah maybe was swallowed by a dinosaur. All right,
the Bible doesn't talk about musk oxen either, right? I mean, there's a lot of things that the Bible does not, because that wasn't the point of the Bible, is to give us a taxonomy.
That's, you know, I think that's a great point, actually, because one of the things that you're actually going to find is you're going to say, hey, there's something in the world I see, and the Bible doesn't talk about that. And one of the things you can assume is that what the Bible's trying to do is give you all knowledge for everything. That's not the point of the Bible. The point of the Bible is, it's actually really simple. It's to tell you a story that is going to lead you to Jesus Christ, and it is going to give you something that when you have faith in Jesus Christ, you can have salvation, and you can be part of God's family. And so it's actually a really simple, like, point of what the Bible is doing. It's not trying to give you everything. It's certainly not trying to answer all your scientific questions. It's certainly not trying to figure out, like, hey, we've been digging and we found this thing in the ground and it looks like an animal we've never seen before. It's pretty crazy. The thing might have breathed fire and stuff. And we're like, Bible, answer this. And the Bible's like, dude, you don't need to know the answer to that to go to heaven. So I didn't spend time with that because it was hard enough to give you this just so that you could know enough to go to heaven. And so, guys, you haven't even read the whole Bible anyway. Don't wish it was longer, all right? Please, like, just read it and just thank God that it wasn't longer. Like, that's what we got. He didn't, you know, give another 2,000 pages to explain dinosaurs.
Yeah, just along with that, I mean, the Bible is obviously an amazing book, and there's sometimes people will point out even little inconsistencies in the Old Testament. You know, one place it talks about this battle and it says 5,000 people died. And one place it talks about this, the same battle, but it says 10,000 people died. Well, what happened? The Bible's wrong. We're throwing it out. I'm out of here, right? Well, there's lots of ways to harmonize those things. I mean, like, for example, with those kind of things, a lot of people in ancient battles, they didn't die until a week later, right? People got hurt, and then twice as many died because of infections within a couple weeks, right? So there's a ton of ways to think about those things. But just like David said, the Bible isn't meant for us to be, it's not a scientific document with precise measurements and stuff like that. That's not the intention. It's better to approach it, some people say, approach it like a love letter. This is God, right? He wants you to know him. And so this is the record of him revealing himself to the world. And so just like if you've been praying for a girlfriend forever, and then she sends you a letter, you are gonna pour over that letter and you are gonna turn it sideways and you're gonna hold it up to the light and you're gonna look at it and you're gonna think, what did she mean by this word, right? And you're gonna think about it. And you are gonna suck all of the marrow out of the bones of that letter, right? And it's better if we approach the Bible like a love letter from God. He's like, this is what I want you to know about me. First, I'm a creator, and I'm powerful, and I'm good, and I'm creative, and right? And then you're made in my image. And it goes on, right? So, there you go.
What about, we've got certain laws in the Old Testament, like, hey, don't eat pork, don't eat shellfish, and we do that, and I love pork, it's great, shellfish, kind of. We do that, but then there's other parts of the Bible that we say, no, hey, sex before marriage, that's something God actually cares about today. Why the distinction? Why, if we don't follow this old part, why do we follow any of it?
It's a huge answer. I think the really simple answer is to look at when Jesus comes, it's the hinge of the story. A lot changes after that. There's a new covenant that's put in place. You look at the heart of the Old Testament law, and a lot of that is why some of those things carry over. But the things that Jesus changed is why we don't. I mean, it's why we don't do sacrifices and why we can eat bacon.
Yep.
The Old Testament, understand, is much of it is written for religious purposes, but also it was a community, a nation of people that had to be governed. And so there are certain laws and restrictions and different things that help them in a civil kind of way that, exactly, Jesus becomes the hinge, kind of changes the trajectory of how we think about all those kind of things. And he's very clear about that. So, but yeah.
All right, real quick. Not maybe real quick, but you know, one of the questions said, okay, my friend wouldn't believe in a God who allows five-year-old to get cancer, right? So, big question. Horrible things happen in this world. The Bible presents us with an idea of God as in control and sovereign. And so the logical conclusion is, okay, God allowed this horrible thing happen to a five-year-old, right? Why would a God do that? And if that's true, I don't want to believe in a God like that. What do we do with this? I mean, we've all faced this, right? Yeah.
You know, C.S. Lewis went from being an avowed atheist, brilliant man, to being a champion for Christianity. And he would say that, I hear God in my pleasures and in the quiet moments, but through pain, he said, pain is the megaphone of God to rouse a sleeping world. All of us would say that there are things that we encounter and ways that our eyes are open and alertness to things that are beyond this material world that actually come to us wrapped strangely through pain. And I know for me personally, much of the loss and pain that I've encountered in this life has actually been moments to draw me near to Christ and get me to think beyond this material world in ways that I would have never encountered had everything just gone placidly and smoothly. And you guys, one of the greatest apologetics for the purpose or the plan, divine plan for pain is that Jesus Christ suffered horribly, horrific death in order to bring the best good, and that is to sweep all of us into heaven and to join him forever. And so God is not averse to using pain for good purposes. And so I just think we have to think differently about even, is the purpose of life to have a pain-free existence? And I would ask you to doubt yourself if that would be a conclusion. I think it's worth doubting that.
And it's such a good topic to, you can find that story written from beginning to end of the Bible. I was even just reading something about it today that, you know, if you're looking at the story of the Bible, I mean, God had redemption and restoration planned before the fall happened. It wasn't like after suffering entered the world. It wasn't after Adam and Eve, you know, surprised God by sinning. Then God's like scrambling around for plan B. Like that's not how it was. It was before the beginning of time, God had already written this book of life with the names of the saints in it. And so, there's the fall and suffering and pain and horrible tragedy. A really oversimplified statement says, why did God allow pain to enter into the world? Because that is how the whole world would be saved. It's from the pain of Jesus. And then to be able to even just carry that into the New Testament and say, Jesus was a man of sorrows. I mean, David was a king of sorrows. You know, just like that's, he wasn't detached from it. And to get it just down to like boots on the ground, like practical, like, it's one thing to have theory on this. It's another thing, like, when it really hits your life. My family had a horrible tragedy a couple years ago where my sister's 7-week-old died of SIDS. He just didn't wake up after a nap. He died. Mm-hmm. And I remember my sister feeling, obviously, in just in shock and in the worst grief you could ever imagine a young mom to feel. And the comfort she could hold on to was, people would say to her, someone said, like, I have no idea what it feels like to lose a son. But God does. Mm-hmm. He knows what that feels like. And that's right there. Like, that's just, again, the story of the whole Bible then comes into one sentence of, like, this is a God who's made himself known, a God who has come near to his people in their pain and everything. And so, yeah, big topic. But.
Yeah, and you're also assuming that that 5-year-old who died of cancer won't be resurrected. You know, you're assuming that it's all over. It was a pointless life. Well, you have to live in a world where there's this God that can raise people from the dead and show them amazing things after that, right? And that changes your perspective on a lot of those horrible things. If you really do believe in the resurrection, God's son died through horrible pain, and he rose from the dead. I mean, that's awesome.
All right, it's 9:30, guys. It's hard to answer a lot of questions. There's so many questions that are really good in here. I'll answer one really quick. How do you explain Trump's popularity among evangelicals, given that he seems to be the antithesis of Christian values? Yeah, Jeff. Did you vote for Trump? Yeah, nope. Okay, anyway. So, yeah, I'd say, no, you're right. He does seem to be the antithesis of Christian values. All right, move on. I think that, yeah, that's a really complex. I'm not going to actually simplify it that much. It's a more complex answer to that, but give it to say, not every evangelical voted for Trump. Here's the thing, guys. The questions that
Nor do I want to shame anybody in this room that did.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Okay. It was super hard. Me and my closest friends would argue back and forth, and we ended up different places, and there's no judgment. Yeah. It was a brutal election, wasn't it? All right. Yeah, it was tough. Hopefully we'll get some good stuff on the table this next time. Guys, thanks so much for this. And if there's definitely questions that we totally didn't get to, and you guys are why didn't you answer this? We need you to answer this. We're around. Come talk to us.
Okay, I said resources. Tim Keller, The Reason for God. That would be number one of just this general area of, I've got a lot of questions about God. Lives in the most secular city, New York City. Talks to secularists. Every chapter begins with a real life conversation that this chapter isn't just cherry picking. Really hard questions from a really serious skeptic. And he takes the time to answer it well. So Reason for God by Tim Keller would be something that I think you should read.
And I say, again, not trying to be sassy, read your Bible. I mean, specifically, it's Hebrews 4 talks about the word of God is living and active. That's a more common verse that we know. But the beautiful context of that is it's actually talking about how do you enter into the rest that you get with belief. So that's essentially what we're talking about here tonight is what do you do with your doubts? Well, you come under the word of God, which is essentially like a surgeon's tool, and he comes in and he very delicately and gently separates belief from unbelief. He will separate, he'll take our belief, like Dalton's saying, and help our unbelief. So I say, yes, read that book and read your Bible.
First.
Yeah. Cool. All right, guys. Thanks so much for giving us some time and, giving us some questions. Thanks. Guys, these kind of questions are best answered in community, right? And so even from a stage, right, it's we're going to be able to give a little bit of some thoughts on some stuff, but the best way to actually deal with doubt is to be in a community of people who love Jesus and be in a community of people like the Salt Company that you're going to be able to come in and say, hey, actually, I have doubt, I have skepticism, and I just want to say, man, this is a really safe place to be. If you're here for the very first time tonight, and even some of our conversation, you're like, dude, I have more doubts because of that. I mean, I don't know, but I really want to invite you guys back. Be part of this community. It's a really safe place to be hey, I'm not actually, I'm not a Christian, and I have, a lot of questions about this, but there's something about Jesus that's compelling for me. I just say, keep coming back. Safe place to ask those questions. So we love you guys. We'll see you next week.